guy named Neil Hansen.
And, oh, okay.
You know Neil?
I know of him, yeah.
Yeah, and Neil grew up around here, and
yeah.
So we're talking to you about baseball and community, and we're going to be talking to him about community, and because it's
well, it would help a lot for me to hopefully put you in Eau Claire around the late 40s and 50s.
Okay.
Because, you know, we didn't have television, and very few of us had cars, bicycles, that's about it.
Okay.
And so during the summer, the only place to be was at the beach or the ballpark, Carson Park. And if you ever had a picture of the city of Eau Claire, it dawns on you that Carson Park is pretty much in the middle.
Okay.
And so it was so easy for kids to go up there.
Okay. Yeah.
You know, and of course I was, to me, an extremely fortunate kid to get a job up there. And in the summer of 48, I had just gotten out of eighth grade. My dad was electrical inspector of the city. And the Boston Braves owned the Eau Claire Bears. And they sent every year a young guy that wanted to get into the business end of baseball. And so they sent him here to Eau Claire to be the business manager of the ball club. And in 48, it was John Malone.
Okay.
Irish kid from Boston. Well, I was basically only 13 because my birthday was June 11th, which, by the way, is the same birthday that Vince Lombardi was, if that means anything to you. But I was only 13 at that time because John Malone called somebody from the city and said, I've got an electrical problem here. Call Bill Roach. And so he found out my dad, and it had to have been on a weekend because I was home. It had to have been on a Saturday. And my dad went up there and did something and got it fixed. And my dad said, by the way, John, would you have a job for a young lad? And John Malone said, I just might. Bring him up. Who is it? My son. Bring him up. So Dad came home and got me, and I went up there. And John and I think we fell in love together because he liked me, and I adored him, you know. And he said, yeah, Mike Egan, who runs the concession stand, is leaving this year. This is his last year. He's graduating and he's going into the Air Force. And he said, so follow him around. Mm-hmm. Learn what he does. And he said, you got the job. And, you know, I was only 13 years old. Well, you can't do that nowadays when you're 13,
no,
you know.
You can't. But, can't trust him to do it.
I got by with it. And so that year, I just hung out and I learned how to take care of the concession stand. And so to a certain extent, you're managing it. But I would think it was kind of a micro managing it. I mean, after all, you got up there early in the morning and you cleaned the floor, got the water off the floor. We had two huge, big kettle pans, you know, where the cattle drank water out of.
Okay.
Huge, you know. And that's what we had up there. That's where the pop went. 3 o'clock in the afternoon, the ice man came up with two big 100-pound boxes of ice, and it took me an hour to chop all that stuff up. And I think I had to put up with that for 2 years, and then we got modern and got electric ones. And but anyway, I learned the business, and you stocked the stands, and you made sure you had enough candy, and you made sure you had enough Pepsi and all that stuff, and you learned right away what went quickly and what didn't, and got the popcorn all set up, and you got the wieners in the water, cooking and mm-hmm. stuff like that. So it was a full-time job. And the only disadvantage to this was that I never had an opportunity to learn to swim. So I never enjoyed Half Moon Lake. And in those days, that lake was as clear as a bell. Mm-hmm. Beautiful place to be. We lived down Shawtown, which was down here in this corner. And the older ladies of Shawtown would go past my dad's house, cane pole and a little can of worms. And hour and a half later, they would come back with a string of sunfish and bluegills. Man, oh man, they were huge, you know. Mm-hmm. And you could tell it lasted them all week, you know. All they had to do was cook up a couple of them and they had something, you know. And I worked up there until the ending of the baseball season, 53. So the first year was 1948. And you were up there all day. And players would come up there and have batting practice, you know. And you just got to know them. Sometimes you had the opportunity to go out in the field and catch fly balls. And you know, there was this little squirt out there catching fly balls. And they would get on your case. Roachy, watch that ball, you know. You got to look at that ball, you know. And they had, they got a kick out of hassling me, you know. But that happened from time to time. And they knew I worked in the concession stand. And the only other guy up there was the groundskeeper. Okay. He and I worked there all day. And then our secretary, Dorothy Wall, was up there all day because that's where the office was during the summer.
Okay.
She would answer the phone and sell tickets and stuff. And if she needed anything, you know, holler down, Artie, you know, what do you want? Well, go down and get this and go down and get that. And Chuck Tanner was the first guy that I really got to like. He had a personality that wouldn't end. He would go out of his way, and he would rap on the concession door. Artie, how are you doing? I'm doing fine. Do you want a Coke? No, I can't have one now, but I'll pick one up when I'm through batting practice. He would come in and have a Coke with me, you know, and just, you know, to treat a 14-year-old kid, you know, as if it was his brother or something, you know, and just always go out of his way to say hello, you know, how you doing, Artie, you know, and things like that. And every team, there was somebody like that. In 1950, it was Billy Bruton. And these guys all made the majors, you know, mm-hmm. surprisingly. And on Chuck Tanner's team, there was a Henry Hannebrink. He made the majors. And he was a nice guy. He would occasionally see me. And, how you doing, Artie? Fine. And so, you know, you thought that was big stuff. Well, your high school friends, you know, they thought that was pretty neat that
looked up to you.
That dude is there up the ballpark, you know, meeting all these guys and drinking Coke all day, and you know, it was a great time, and we got I think it was maybe. I worked in 49, and I think in 50, we got a Salisbury scooter. And in those days, you had the Cushman scooter. Mm-hmm. And a lot of kids could get those because they were, well, I don't know how much they were, but they were obviously cheap enough where their parents maybe bought them. But the Salisbury was a real slick looking one, you know, and man, could that baby go. And we had a sidecar on it because during the seventh inning, Roger House, the groundskeeper, would drive it around the infield and they would drag the infield and smooth it out and the guy would sit in that sidecar.
Okay.
And I would use it during the day. I would have to go down to do the banking at the Union National Bank. It was the Union National Bank then. I can't remember what it is now. The American National Bank is now Wells Fargo. And we would, the Bears would change off from a month to the other to utilize both banks. And we would do that with a Burry's bread and tender crust bread. We would buy their bread 1 month and so on. And so I used to go downtown quite a bit with that scooter. And generally, every time I got back, Dorothy was waiting at the gate of the ballpark. Yes, Dorothy, what do you want? Well, I got a call from somebody that you were going a little too fast over the Grand Avenue Bridge. Oh, yeah. You know, if you ruin that scooter, you're paying for it, you know. And I never did ruin it, but I did go a little too fast, you know. But for 14, 15, 16-year-old kid, what does he know, you know? Doesn't have enough common sense to slow down, you know.
Yes.
Because I think I'd just take off. And one time we picked up, there was a ball player coming over across the Grand Avenue Bridge. He was going up to the park, I suppose. And I had just got back from the bank, and I stopped and picked him up. And he said, well, Artie, I was going to stop at Amoni's and get some breakfast. And okay, I can do that. So we stopped. And I stayed on the scooter, and he said, well, come in with me. Well, I had to been only 15. And I went in and sat down, and the ball player ordered some food, and the bartender said, what do you want? Well, you know, I was so surprised, I didn't know what to do. And to this day, I couldn't figure out why I said, I want a whiskey sour. You know, of all things, you know, it was maybe 10, 11 o'clock in the morning, you know. And he thought I was a ball player. And he gave me one. And that was the first time I had anything stronger than near beer, you know. And it was one thing I never told my dad or my mother, because they would have taken my little Irish posterior and banged me up pretty good, you know. And we got to know some of the ball player, some of the big wheels from the Boston Braves. When they were still in Boston, they would contact the Eau Claire Bears, because they had ball players that, hey, we got a ball player that we signed, and we're going to bring him out because we think he'll do good at Class C ball and things like that. And they always, every day, we had to send a report to the Boston Braves on what the concession stand did that night, dollars and cents. So we had to justify the money that we got for what we sold. And it was pretty detailed. Mm-hmm. You had to say how many bottles of pop you sold, how many you broke, if you broke any, candy bars, and the bottom line had to balance.
Yeah.
And Dorothy called me in one day and said, John Carnes from Boston called. And I knew John Carnes. He was a business manager, the general manager of the Boston Braves. And he said, by the way, who makes out the concession report? And Dorothy said, well, Art Roach. And he said, well, tell him he does one good job, because we haven't ever had a sheet that we had to question.
Okay.
And so, you know, I thought that was pretty neat. And I finally met him when Boston then moved to Milwaukee. He came with him. He left Boston and was still the general manager of the Milwaukee Braves. And that's when they would come up, because Milwaukee, Eau Claire was pretty close. And they would come up from time to time and enjoy a day with us and take in the ball game. And he said, Art, what are you going to do when you get out of high school? And I said, well, I don't know. And he said, well, why don't you come down to Milwaukee and learn the concession stand business? And I said, I think I have to go through my dad on that. Well, he said, talk to him, you know. And my dad said, no, I don't want you to go to Boston. But we had other problems because in those days, the draft was still there.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And unknown to me, all of the other guys would go down to the Selective Service Office and raise their number up.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I did it after I got out of high school, way too late. And I still had to wait a year and a half. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you can imagine the amount of kids that move their number up, you know. And but I often thought, oh, man, wouldn't it have been nice to go down to Milwaukee and work? But then shortly after that, they moved to Atlanta. And so I thought, well, I don't know where Atlanta, Georgia is. I would have to look that up in a map. And I said, I don't know if I want to go to Georgia or not. Well, I guess where I ended up in the Army, Fort Benning, Georgia. And so, you know, it's one of those things. And one evening, there was 8 or 9 girls that worked in the concession stand. Three or four of them went from Shawtown. They were my neighbors. And there was one whose husband was the sergeant of the police force, Wally Rudd. Have you ever been in what is now the Corton House?
The courthouse?
The Corton House, the tavern?
No, I haven't been to Corton House.
Well, that's Old Mooney's. And it's run by Girolamo's now. But there's a picture of Wally Rudd. He was a great guy. And because his wife worked up there, he was up there all the time on duty. He was a policeman on duty. And one day Dorothy hollered down, Art, yeah, get down to the police station. What do I want to go down there for? Well, I don't know. I'm not the policeman. Go down there. And, well, how am I going to go down there? Well, take the scooter. Okay. Took the scooter and walked into the police station, and the sergeant or the policeman on duty just walked around the corner, and there he was. And he looked down at me and he said, and what do you want? And I said, well, I'm supposed to be here. And well, he said, what's your name? And I said, Art Roach. And all of a sudden I heard, Artie, get in here. And where'd that come from? The guy said, that's Sergeant Wally Rudd's office right around the corner. And gave me a look. Boy, have you had it now? You know, whatever's your problem, you've got a problem. So I walked in there. Sit down. Oh, okay. Did I see you driving that scooter yesterday morning downtown? Well, Wally, no. Would I do something like that? I saw you. And he gave me a card. I was only 14 years old. He gave me this card. And he said, read that. And so I read it. Wow. This is a driver's license. He said, read the whole thing. I'm reading the whole thing. What's that bottom line there? Read that bottom line. Drive only during daytime. He said, if I catch you driving at night, you won't ever get a license in the state of Wisconsin. And I had a driver's license at 14. And took that home to my dad. And he looked at that and he said, how'd you get this? And Wally Rudd gave it to me. And Wally Rudd and my dad knew each other because the police department was right behind City Hall where my dad had his office. And my dad saw Wally Rudd one morning and he said, "Geez, why are you giving my son a driver's license?" "Well, he knows how to drive and he drives that scooter."
Yeah.
And he said, "As long as he drives only during the day, he's fine, you know." And so when I got into high school and those kids knew that I had a driver's license and drove them nuts, you know, man, you know. And there was another a policeman that sometimes covered up there, German guy, Joe Bender. And I always thought he was a Nazi because he was one tough cookie. He didn't like kids. And the concession stand door, you could reach around and unlatch it and walk in the concession stand. And I just happened to be at the end of the concession stand serving a bottle of near beer when Joe Bender came up and reached around. I said, "What are you doing, Joe?" "Well," he said, "I'm coming in." And I said, "No, you're not. You don't belong back here." Mm-hmm. "Well," he said, "I want to go see Sally, you know." And I said, "Sally's working, you know. Stay out of here." "Well," he said, "who do you think you are, you little snip?" And I said, "Well, I think I have the right to tell you to stay out of this concession stand. We're working." And he tried it again. Well, I had the bottle in my hand, but I hadn't opened it yet. And he reached in there again, and I hit his hand with a bottle of beer. He said, "Do you know what you just did?" I said, "Yes. I hit your hand because you're not coming in here. I'm going to get you for that. You assaulted a police officer." "Well, actually, I did." But it just so happened that Sergeant Wally Rudd's wife saw this whole thing. And Joe left. He was ticked off. He was mumbling something about getting me. And Lee came over and said, "Art," he said, she said, "I saw the whole thing. Don't worry about it." So Wally Rudd comes down later, and Lee got her husband over there and obviously told him the whole thing. And Wally didn't say anything to me. He just walked by. But he was standing around, and Joe Bender came back. And Wally nailed him, got him up against the wall, and started poking in his chest, obviously saying, "You stay out of there, you know, and don't worry about what Art did, because what he did was right, you know," and all this stuff. And I could see over Wally Rudd's shoulder, Joe looking at me with those two German eyes, you know. And, oh, man, they would kill you if you... And but he never did anything to me. Oh, man, that was something else. That was a great experience. It was only years later, at the end of a game, we'd count the money. Dorothy would be counting the money that came from tickets and cushions, and I think that's about all, but I would count all the money that came from the concession stand. And we came to the final figure, put it in the bank bag, and locked it. We had a key, and the bank had a key, and after we were through, we would call the police, and they would come up, and we would go down to they would follow us down to the bank, and we'd drop it in the night deposit. But it dawned on me years later that they never questioned me handling all that money. And sometimes we would take down $5,000.
Yeah.
Well, in 1950, $5,000 wasn't a pennies, you know. And they never questioned. And it was it didn't dawn on me until I was an old man, you know, and thought, man, oh man, I 14, 15, 16 years old handling all that money, and it was a great experience. And I went to St. Pat's Catholic School, and in our sophomore year, they started to build Regis High School out on Fenwick Avenue. It took them 3 years to build that, because we graduated out of Regis, but not the building. We graduated out of the name of Regis. But my junior and senior year, the principal, Father Paul, would get donations for the school. And every afternoon at a dinner time when everybody was out playing, he would have me take that money down to the bank in his car, because he knew that I drove. And he had a little Oldsmobile coupe. And in those days, could Oldsmobiles go? I mean, they were hot rods. And I would back it out of the garage, and I would take off, well, to drive the principal's car. You know, these other guys said, what is that guy doing, driving Father Paul's car, you know? And every afternoon, I'd go down and take that money down to the bank. And occasionally, Father Paul would be out there when I got back, give me his finger to get over there, you know. How did you get back here? I said, what do you mean? He said, what route did you take? Well, over the Grand Avenue Bridge. I'm going a little fast, weren't you? I said, come on, I wasn't going fast. Well, that's not what this telephone call was all about that I just got, you know. And he said, you know, that's my car you're driving. Yeah. Well, he said, slow down a little bit. Okay. Yeah. So you get things like that going. And, those experiences were great. We had a chance to get down to County Stadium when they built that. For the first year, Milwaukee sent up a bunch of tickets for us, and the business manager, I can't remember who that was, every year we had a new business manager, and I should have kept their names, because each one of them was so different. There was one, Wally Brock, who came from New York, and the interesting thing about him was he dressed like $1 million. White shirts pressed to the ultimate, and suits fit him like a glove. And that's what he would come to work in, you know. You're in Eau Claire, you know, you're not in Manhattan, you know. You know, get on some pants or something, you know. But this is the way he dressed, and he had a very lope to him when he walked. And he would always come down to the concession stand and, what are you doing? Well, Wally, I'm working, you know. Well, can you take me downtown? Yeah. But Wally, the only thing we got here is the scooter. Well, okay. I would go in and get a bunch of cushions. We sold cushions in those days, 10 cents a cushion for people to sit there watching the ballgame. And I would put five or six of them in there, and he would sit there, you know. And the first time we went down there, he was really relaxed, you know. This is really neat, you know, wind blowing and a nice warm day. And all of a sudden he had the edges of that seat he was hanging on to him, and he wasn't moving. And I said, Wally, will you watch the road, you know? And I'm watching the road. Are you all right? Yes, I'm all right. When you went down Grand Avenue in those days, you went over two railroad tracks. And you could get that airborne. You didn't go off the ground very much, but you could get that airborne if you hit it just right. Mm-hmm. And from time to time I did, you know. And it was a foolish thing to do, because if that sidecar ever broke off there, I would be in big trouble, you know. But it never did. But apparently I got pretty close one time when Wally was in there. And boy, that was the end of that, you know. And the few times that he had to go down, he said, Art, I demand that you slow down. That you don't hit those railroad tracks like you generally do. And okay, Wally. And he survived, you know. And when business manager that came in, he was a nice guy. But he was just the opposite of Wally Brock. He couldn't wear anything and look nice. And he came from New York. Thought, wow. What's different about New York? Are there that great a contrast? Well, apparently there were. But this guy had pants that were too long and too big and too floppy. You know, just as a kid, I dressed better than he did, you know. But he was a nice guy. He wouldn't even get in my scooter. He wouldn't even get in.
He'd be better.
No, he would wait until one of the Big Bears cars was up there. And there was a ball player that they signed. I wish I could have remembered his name. I don't know why, but he signed a big bonus, $5,000 bonus. Well, in those days, $5,000 was a ton of money. Mm-hmm. Well, the first thing he did when he got to Eau Claire, he went down to the Buick dealership and bought himself a Buick, and it had everything that cars had in those days on that Buick. And one day he knocked on the concession stand door and came in, and he said, Artie said, where do you live? And I said, well, with my mother and dad. And he said, where? And I said, well, it's by Lutheran Hospital. Well, he said, would your dad mind if you took my car and kept it for me until we get back from the road trip? In those days, they had road trips that lasted 10, 12 days, because they had to go out to Aberdeen, South Dakota, and Grand Forks, and Sioux Falls, and Fargo-Moorhead. They made that whole route, and man, they were gone for 10, 12 days. And without even asking my dad, I said, well, of course, it's safe. I'll park it along Beach Street, and that's perfectly safe. Well, he said, because where I live, I can't trust it, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I bring this humongous Buick home and park it in, on the side of the house. And I didn't think anything of, Mom, don't worry about that car. That's I brought that home. I didn't even think of it. You know, I just took the keys up to the my bedroom, and I wouldn't have driven that car anyways. Mm-hmm. Well, my dad came home, and Jakey, whose car is that out there? Well, I don't know. Okay. So we get up in the morning, and that car's still there. My dad said, Jakey, that car is still there. Whose is that? Well, I was in the bathroom, and I heard Dad say that, and I said, well, Dad, that I brought that. What do you mean you brought that? Well, I said, it's a ball player's. What are you doing with that car? I said, they're on a road trip. He wanted me to bring it home and keep it safe. Mm-hmm. He said, where are the keys to that car? I said, they're up in my bedroom. He said, go up and get them. Give them to me. And I said, well, you don't think I'm going to drive that, do you? You know, I'm just keeping it for him, you know. He got pretty tight about it because he knew that was a $5,000 car, you know. That had spotlights on it and fog light. Oh, man, there was something there. So, I was in the monastery for a while down in La Crosse, and this was after I was out of the army and everything, and somebody gave us brothers 5 or 6 tickets to a Milwaukee game. Our monastery is down in DeSoto, Wisconsin, a little town down along the river, and this guy that donated that land to us was a big wheel out in New York. I don't know what, I think he was into financing or something. And I think he was the one that gave us those tickets, although I couldn't be sure. But anyway, they knew that I had worked for a ball club, and they knew that I told him I knew Hank Aaron, but of course, you know, it's like, yeah, I know the Pope too. But so they included me in there, and we got one of our cars and drove and went to the ball game. And it was an old county stadium, and you could go right up to the fence where the dugouts were. And they had batting practice, and Hank was out there with a bunch of other ball players. Can't remember who they all were, but 3 or 4 of them would come in, and 3 or 4 of them would get through batting, and they would go out, and 3 or 4 would come in and start batting practice. And here comes Hank and 2 ball players, and they kind of walk along the fence, and they walked right past us, and Hank looked at us. And I didn't say hello, I didn't wink, I didn't change expressions at all. And one of the brothers said, huh, well, so much for you knowing Hank Aaron. And, you know, I felt kind of bad about that. And all of a sudden, out of the dugout comes Hank Aaron, and he stands right in front of us. And he says, don't I know you? He said, I can't remember where. But he said, boy, you look familiar. And I said, how about Eau Claire? Oh, my gosh, he said, you were that young kid in the concession stand. And, you know, I looked at my fellow brothers and, well, and, well, you don't have to get so uppy about it, you know. And they didn't say a word, you know. Got back to the monastery. Yeah, he knows. I mean, it was a big deal, you know. And that was a lot of fun that time.
So you were a Braves fan, Milwaukee Braves fan also, and
yeah.
Were you a fan when they went to Atlanta or?
No, I stayed with. Well, when Hank played with him, I did. And then Hank came back to Milwaukee, of course, and played for the Milwaukee Brewers, and that's where he finished up his baseball career. And but I often regret we went down to the new stadium. Coincidentally, again, the first year that stadium was open, we took a bus trip down there through the telephone company. And we got to see a game there. And it wasn't until I got home that I went through their a scorecard, their big book that they print. And there was Chuck Tanner working for the Milwaukee Brewers. Mm-hmm. And I thought, oh, you know, I would have had time to contact somebody who could at least have called him.
Yeah.
And if we couldn't talk, it's a lot better than not doing anything. You know? Oh, man. But it was too late. And then when the new owner of the ball club, when this guy who owns it now bought it from Bud's, Ananasio,
yeah.
Something like that. Well, Chuck Tanner went back to Pittsburgh, and then he died this past year. But you know, I'm sure he would have remembered me. My son Danny. Is my youngest son. Their mother died in 88, and they were just all entering high school because they were born in 71, 72, and 73. And they were just entering high school, and my wife ended up with cancer. And that. But anyway, Danny was the youngest, and he had a friend in high school, and apparently Dan was over at their house visiting, and Danny called me. I happened to be home, and he said, "Dad," "can you come over to Murphy's house?" And well, yeah. Well, he said, "There's somebody here who knows you." Well, who is it? And Dan said, "Well, I'm not sure, but he knows you." Well, he knew, but he wouldn't tell me. "Yeah, I can come over." And in 1950, I think it was, we had a ball player, Chet Morgan, who I got to like. He was a nice guy. He came in and had a bottle of Coke with me from time to time, too. And I went into the Murphy house, and Dan's friend Mike said, "Oh, hi, Mr. Roach, how are you?" "Fine." And he said, "Well, there's somebody here that knows you, I think." And I said, "Where is he?" And Mike said, "Well, he's not here right now." Well, just about that time, this car drives up, and this guy gets out, and man, oh man, that's Chet Morgan. And he remembered me, you know. I said, "Well, Chet, you haven't changed a bit. You're still skinny like you were 100 years ago." And he said, "Well, well, you haven't changed all that much either with your big ears and all that stuff, you know, fine thing. And he said, when your son Dan told me who he was, I said to myself, your dad has to be Artie Roach. And Dan said, yeah. But all those years, you know, it just surprised me. Oh, man, that was something else. Turn that off for me.